You're listening to the Prepper Recon Podcast. For questions, comments, and podcast archives, go to PrepperRecon.com. Ready-Made Resources is a trusted name in the prepper community because they've been around for 18 years. They offer great prices on night vision, water filtration, long-term storage food, solar energy components, and provide free technical service. Get ready for an uncertain future at ReadyMadeResources.com. Trading Post in the Woods is ran by veteran crisis responders who know how important it is to be prepared. They specialize in comprehensive natural survival remedy kits, preparedness and homesteading supplies, as well as skills training. Visit them online today at tradingpostinthewoods.com. Hey, Preppers and Patriots. This is the second half of my interview with New Hampshire Representative Dan Itza. Enjoy the show. Dan, you wrote a book called States Have Powers. One of the chapters is called Limits of Powers. We rarely hear anything about the limits on government, especially from government. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Well, the first limit on government you have is your state constitution. That's why we have constitutions, is to give the people a reference guide, because a constitution is worth nothing unless you enforce it. But if you know your constitution, then you know the powers that your various organs of government are supposed to have. And one thing that's fairly common to every state is that the legislature is the supreme legislative power. Our state has a beautiful Article 29 in our Bill of Rights, and I'm not going to try and look at it because I don't want to spend time doing that, but to articulate as best I can, the suspension and execution of the laws ought to be exercised only by the legislature and executed only in as the legislature shall expressly provide for. You read that. Does the judiciary have any power pursuant to a court case to say to the executive branch, don't practice that law, it's unconstitutional? No. Only the legislature can suspend a law. The repeal of a law is a legislative act. If all the legislative power resides in the legislature, no other branch of government can repeal a law or cause it to not, or cause it to be suspended or not executed. But the legislature has to stand up and defend their power, which is really the people's power. I love our first article in our Bill of Rights because, and this is one of the things I found in reading our Constitution and the other period constitutions, is that the Constitution of the State of New Hampshire is probably the best articulation of American liberty, bar none. And that comes in part because of when it was created. We had the first – New Hampshire is the first free state – I call it free state because there was no king. It's the first free state created by a written constitution in the history of the world. We completed that constitution on January 5th, 1776, and it was intended as a temporary constitution to see us through the war. Later in 76, all of the states other than Massachusetts wrote their constitutions. Then in 79, we had the first constitutional convention in the world, but that did not result in the constitution. The people of New Hampshire rejected it. But Massachusetts passed a constitution in September of 79. When we finally get to our constitution proposed in 1783 and then ratified by the people in 1784, we were looking back at all of the other state constitutions, and we cherry-picked the best out of each one. It's often construed that New Hampshire was a knockoff on Massachusetts, and that nothing could be farther from the truth. The reason you see a lot of Massachusetts constitution in New Hampshire, but you also see it in the Pennsylvania constitution that was passed in 76, was because in 76 at the convention for the Declaration of Independence, Adams was asked to write a blueprint for state constitutions. And he did so. And Pennsylvania, Maryland, and a couple of the others of that period are based upon what he wrote. Well, then when he went to write the Massachusetts Constitution, of course it looked like what he had written in 76. And then, but we went back and cherry-picked out of all the other constitutions. Our Article 10 looks like the Maryland equivalent, not the Massachusetts equivalent. But we have as our Article 1 something that exists in no other state constitution. And as far as I know, no other constitution in the world. All men are born equally free and independent, which is a reference to our state of nature. Therefore, all government of right, that's all legitimate government, originates in the people, is founded in consent, and instituted for the general good. And that is as perfect a paraphrase of the last of Locke's chapter 9, the ends of government, the purpose of government. And what he's saying is, because we all, as much as we approximate the state of nature, we all approximate that state of nature at birth equally. We are all equally free and independent. And in our state of nature, if we truly had one, each and every man has complete legislative, executive, and judicial authority within his sphere, within his property. But when we enter into a state of society, we surrender up some of those powers to that government that we create for the purpose of having them created better. If we're just living in our state of nature, my neighbor and I might not agree on particular laws that we imagine to ourselves, and so we'd have controversy there. If my neighbor comes and violates my law, he may not agree that I violated my law. And when I go to apprehend him for violating my law, he might fight back and I might get killed. So we surrender up those powers to hopefully a impartial government that administrates the laws that we allow our legislature to make. We surrender up to our legislature a certain level of lawmaking power, and we agree that we will submit ourselves to those laws that are created in our name, and we have an impartial executive who's going to execute those laws and an impartial judiciary who's going to adjudicate whether or not those laws have actually been violated. Well, when we do that, okay, so the powers of government has no power that does not first reside in the individual. We've delegated it to them. It's founded in consent. Because we are all born equally free and independent, no one can be put under the governance of another but by his own consent. And it's instituted for the general good. And this is a paraphrase of Locke, but it's pretty verbatim. No rational creature would put himself under the governance of another except that he supposed his condition would be better than in his state of nature. Therefore, the power of the legislature can extend no further than the general good, which in reverse defines the general good. The general good is that no law can leave any member of the community in no worse condition than if there were no law and no government. That general good, Locke actually refers to it as the common good. Our Article 1 refers to it as a general good. Article 10 refers to it as common benefit, and the Constitution for the United States refers to it as the general welfare. You can see the similar construction in all of them: common, general, good, welfare. But that is the principle, that government can do no harm to your state of nature.
Boy, our current folks on the left certainly have a different translation for general welfare.
They certainly do, but I'm going back to the guy. We all, and this is one of the things that hit me, actually was last summer. I'd read Locke in the summer of, in the winter of 14-15, and then I guess it was in the summer of 15, July, so it's been, you know, rattling around in my gray matter for 6 months. And all of a sudden I looked at Article 1, and all of a sudden it hit me. that this is what this means, and we all wonder what does the general welfare mean. Locke defined it, and all of our governments are based on Locke. We're very fortunate in New Hampshire that we have this, that Article 1 is such a fine paraphrase of Locke's ends of government. But which identifies our Constitution as a Lockean social contract, and therefore brings in the totality of Locke's Second Treatise on Government as a reference document as to what our Constitution means, unless it says something specifically different. But when you then understand what Locke meant by what he called the common good, or these other phrases that are equivalent, the whole paradigm of government changes. That one sentence for New Hampshire, that's the whole Constitution. All the other articles in our Bill of Rights become expository on that first article, and then the form of government is expository on the Bill of Rights. Those 27 words define American government.
You've got another chapter in your book, States Have Powers, called Unauthorized Federal Officers. Can you give us a quick synopsis of that chapter and give us some examples of unauthorized federal officers?
An unauthorized federal officer. The Constitution for the United States is very specific. It gives Congress the power to create offices. The president has no power to create an office and pay for that office out of the federal treasury. So the question would have to ask yourself, and this goes for President Trump as well, okay, is the president's senior advisor, is that job description, that is that job created by Congress? Is there a federal statute that creates that job? Look at all the hangers-on that President Obama has had during, I mean, he had virtually a shadow government for all his cabinet positions. He had another individual who was advising him on the same matters, but was not appointed by Congress, or was not approved by Congress. Were those offices actually authorized by Congress? Where is the money coming from to pay for those individuals? Unless they're volunteering their services or they're paid for by some outside entity, that's an unauthorized federal office. If you read the Constitution for the United States, the president has no power to create positions. Only Congress does. Maybe as simple as saying, okay, we're going to have a Secretary of State, and that's approved. And that person is approved by the Senate, and so many undersecretaries, and they're approved by the Senate. And then there's 150 underlings, whatever their titles are, and an ambassador, to 200 ambassadors to foreign nations, and those people are just approved by the Department of Secretary of State. But the offices and the money to provide for them is authorized by Congress.
Can you talk to us a little bit about unauthorized means of enactment? And that sounds similar, and also sounds very sinister.
Well, think about executive orders. What are the first 11 words of the Constitution? Not the preamble, but the first 11 words of the Constitution of the United States. All legislative powers granted herein are vested in a Congress comprised of a House of Representatives and a Senate. Therefore, does any other body have any legislative powers? The answer is no. So can the executive branch, president in particular, create an order that affects the people or the states? Can any judge create or repeal any law that affects the people or the states? The answer is simple. All legislative power granted herein is vested in a Congress. End of story. No qualifiers. No excepts. A valid executive order is one in which Congress has passed a law saying the president, the president or some office thereof will do something. An executive order would then be from the president to that department to go do it.
And then,
an executive order that acts upon the people, that doesn't fit within the framework of the Constitution.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. The dollar's lost over 90% of its purchasing power since 1971. Silver, on the other hand, has proven to be a very stable form of wealth preservation over the years. And where do you buy silver? Silver.com, of course. Silver.com offers fantastic prices on gold and silver. Check out Silver.com today. Whether your plan is to bug out or bug in, CampingSurvival.com has all of your preparedness needs, including fish antibiotics, long-term storage food, and water filters. Use coupon code PREPRECON for 5% off your order at CampingSurvival.com. The last chapter in your book is called Secession or Nullification. And as much as I'd like to see California split off and do their own thing and probably, well, Texas and Idaho and, well, I guess everybody for that matter, Lincoln sort of put an end to that question, didn't he? I mean, the preservation of the Union, that doctrine trumps the actual Constitution these days, doesn't it? I mean, it's sort of like you're free to leave anytime you want, but I'll kill you if you do. Sort of like an abusive spouse, right?
Well, again, just think about our founders, and this is one of the things in understanding our constitutions that you really have to do, or an amendment. You have to go and sit down in the seats of the men that were crafting the Constitution or the amendment at that time. What was going through their head? What clothes were they wearing, in essence? Put yourself in their shoes. So let's just imagine that Alexander Hamilton, and I'm James Madison, and we're sitting at the convention.
I really don't want to be Hamilton. Can I be somebody else?
Adams.
Okay.
Jefferson.
Okay. Either one is better than Hamilton.
Okay.
Thank
you. So there you are. Jefferson wasn't there, but Adams was.
Okay. Well, thank Adams.
Okay, so there you are, and you are, we're discussing the Constitution. Now, we have just fought an 8-year war to free ourselves from the government that we and our fathers and our grandfathers and their grandfathers, 9 generations, had trusted to defend their liberty. And all of a sudden, over the 1750s and 60s erupting in 76, we found that government to be dangerous to our liberty. And so dangerous that we're willing to spend blood and treasure to free ourselves from it. Would we have ever entered into a compact from which we could not withdraw legally if we found that that new government become dangerous to our liberty?
Yeah, absolutely not.
Okay, so is the doctrine of not being able to withdraw from the Union a rational doctrine? It's not. Secondly, the thing Lincoln hung his hat on was the phrase perpetual union. The phrase perpetual union, where does it appear? It's in the Articles of Confederation. Those same Articles of Confederation that recognized the sovereign independence of the several states. Now, the Constitution, what does the 10th Amendment to the Constitution say?
It says the states have rights for everything that's not specifically granted to.
No. Powers. First of all, and this is this typo is not the right word, but this is a misquote in my book, because when I repeated the 9th Amendment, I used the word powers, not rights. 9th Amendment deals with rights. 10th Amendment deals with powers. Powers not granted to the government of the United States, not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the people or the states, or the states or the people, respectively. Does the word secession or withdrawal appear anywhere in the Constitution? The answer is no. Therefore, there is specific control given over admitting states to the Union. There is not one word or phrase or peep uttered about states withdrawing from the Union. Therefore, where does that power lie?
With the states.
Correct. Okay. End of story. The unfortunate thing with the conclusion of the Civil War is that with the repatriation of the first Confederate under the government of the United States at the point of a gun, government by consent of the governed vanished from the face of the earth.
Yeah, we went back to might makes right.
Yes. I mean, this is coming from a Yankee, okay? But then, what were the first states? How many of the first 13 states considered secession?
Virginia, North, South Carolina, and Georgia.
Well, you got that one wrong. 9. What were the first states to consider secession?
South Carolina.
No, you're off by about 60 years. First states to consider secession were Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, and New Hampshire in approximately 1801. I forget the precise date. Over Jefferson's prohibition on trading with Great Britain.
So how do we get back to this? I mean, is there any hope of getting past this might makes right mentality that we've all succumbed to, you know, whether it's because it's been proven that we can't physically win the fight and might in that aspect it's more powerful. So it's sort of it's not right, but what are you going to do about it? So how do we get past that? What can we do to get back to the Constitution and the original intent?
Well, people have to become aware of the Constitution. That's why I wrote the book. I mean, you have to really become aware of how the founding fathers viewed the states. In the last chapter, there's a great quote from a letter from the legislature of New Hampshire to then President Jefferson. And it's important because you have to realize the sanitation that occurs during the legislative process. If you read the Kentucky resolutions from 1798, and if you read, you read the draft versions that were identical and very strident, say 2 or 3 pages, from Kentucky and Virginia. And then you read the legislative product that came out of each state. One, they're both distilled down to about a paragraph. And each one picked up different points. Each legislature picked up different points that they chose to champion. If you look at the end result, the actual Kentucky and Virginia resolutions, you would never guess that they were proceeded from the same draft. And they were so watered down as to be only one step short of namby-pamby. So when you read this letter from the legislature of New Hampshire to President Jefferson, the phraseology, and I don't have the book open in front of me, but they state to President Jefferson that the only thing that binds the sovereign and independent states together, the legislatures of the, and that's important, the legislatures of the independent states together, is with the National Council, is a unanimity of purpose. And that's a paraphrase because I'm not reading it. But the point is that there were no binding ties. There were no shackles that kept us together. It was common purpose that kept us together. And our legislature thought of New Hampshire as a sovereign and independent state. And that's in an official document from the legislature. The only answer is we have to get our heads screwed on straight. And I don't know that under the current paradigm it can happen. I mean, because people just don't know it, and can you get an adequate critical mass of people thinking correctly? And with freedom comes risk, and how many people are willing to assume the risk of freedom? And that's another huge issue. But can we push back? Can we start learning what we are supposed to be? Absolutely. I mean, even if we just get our state legislatures to interpose themselves between the people and the federal government. And I hate that term, the federal government. Our founders didn't call it the federal government. They called it the general government, which is much more descriptive. It is the government of the United States. I mean, this is one of the problems I have with the sovereign citizen movement, is they try to apply elements of the Constitution for the United States to state government. And the Constitution is very explicit. When it's referring to things that apply to the states, it says the states, each state, the several states, but it specifically refers to the states themselves. When it uses the phrase United States, that's that group down in Washington, D.C., and the buildings they occupy in the states. It's not the states themselves. Just little subtle things. Our founders were wordsmiths, and they tried to make every word count. You will see the constitutions of the states are the constitutions of the state of New Hampshire, for instance. We are self-constituted. We, the people, constituted the state of New Hampshire. The United States is the constitution for the United States, because the United States did not create itself. It was created by the states and the people of the states.
Dan, you've given us a lot of really, really good stuff to think about. I'd say you said it very well in getting educated and trying to help to share that knowledge, and that's the first step in trying to push back. And I think your book is probably an excellent tool for doing that. If you want to tell everybody one more time the full title of your book and where they can go to find it.
Well, it's available on Amazon. That's the short answer. The title of the book is Law. States have powers, the powers of the people. Use them or lose them.
Very, very well.
Because just like any
excellently titled.
if you let things atrophy, they wither and die. One of the things I find astounding in some of the and I read. I want you to understand, and I want the people to know it. I told you my youngest son is severely disabled,
right.
And beginning in, he's quadriplegic, he can't articulate, but he's intelligent. So beginning, probably a year ago, I started reading to him some of these apocalyptic books, if you want, for a general category. I started with William Fortune's book, and then I read the A American series to him, and I read kind of interleaving because of getting the books. I got read him. I can't remember. It's another equivalent series. I can't remember the name of it at the moment. And then I happened upon your books, and I started with the Collapse series. And then we're almost at the end of the Days of Noah, and I'm thrilled we're getting the Days of Elijah may have come today, actually.
Oh, which fantastic.
I perceive to be a continuation of the Days of Noah. First start with the exit strategy. One of the things I find absolutely astoundingly compelling is in all of these books, there is except, and I'll say I have to compliment you on this, in the American Exit Strategy series, is a government of the United States that perceives itself to exist independent of the states. You have this collapse of state governments, and yet somehow this United States, comprised of the states, which no longer exist, is functioning. And that's an oxymoron. If there are no states, there are no United States. And that one of the things that is really American is the whole idea of bottom-up government. Our Article 6, and this in Massachusetts as well, originally read public morality and piety based on evangelical principles will give the best and greatest security to government and the strongest obligation to due subjection. And I struggled with that. I really hit me. It was the February after I finished my commentary on the New Hampshire Constitution, and I'm going to speak at a thing on in Lexington on Patriots Day. And I'm struggling with these words. Article 6 is buried in all these things like our state sovereignty and natural rights and Article 10, which is our obligation to revolution. How do you have this article which talks about the best and greatest security government and the strongest obligation to do subjection in the middle of all this? What's the subjection? And what are evangelical principles? So I contemplated this for a while, and my pastor just gave me a copy of the Geneva Bible. I'm sitting there thinking, and I said, well, I grew up in a congregational church. My wife grew up in the Catholic Church. What's the biggest difference between those two? Well, in the congregational church, the congregation appoints their pastor. And in the Roman Catholic Church and the Episcopal Church, Church of England, all of those, the pastor is appointed by the church top down. And I suddenly realized that evangelical principles was not a religious statement as much as it was a statement of bottom-up government, church and civil. And the acknowledgement of that, okay, evangelical principles will give the best and greatest security government and the strongest obligation to do subjection. That subjection is of those in government to the governed and of all of us to God. And members of government aware of that subjection will not make or execute laws that will give the people cause to rebel. And so government is secure. The whole principle of American government is bottom-up government. That's why the whole idea of warlords is antithetical to government. That the principle of the militias is not self-organized groups of guys running around in the woods. It is of the military element being subject to the civilian government, which is itself appointed by the people. And that militia is comprised of the whole body of the people, a grand circle.
Very, very excellent thoughts. And once again, it's a lot of great stuff for us to think about. I definitely hope folks are going to pick up your States Have Powers books. And I'm sure if they just put that in the search title on Amazon with Dan, it's going to pop right up. And get that. Read it and then pass it along to a friend, and that's how we start to educate folks and to bring folks back to the original intent. And even if the whole thing does fall apart, at least we'll know what the building blocks were to get back to that point. So Dan, thanks again for making time for us today, and hopefully we'll get you back on the show. And thank you for your patriotism and for your dedication and your work towards keeping us accountable and bringing us back to a constitutional government.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, and I look forward to a blossoming friendship between us.
In A Haunt for Jackals by best-selling author Mark Goodwin, Danny Walker's survival retreat has been devastated by violence since the detonation of the EMP. Regent Slusher's designs on absolute power have already brought him to Danny's doorstep once, leaving a trail of blood and heartbreak in his wake. Another conflict with a malicious dictator will spell certain death for the remaining members of the compound. Danny's only hope is to infiltrate Slusher's camp and bring him down from the inside. It's a risky proposition. If he is caught, he'll be executed as a spy, but there is no other alternative. In this epic struggle between good and evil, Danny's mettle will be tested, his faith will be tried, and he'll have to dig deep for the courage to continue. Buy your copy of A Haunt for Jackals, Book 3 of Seven Cows, Ugly and Gaunt, in paperback, Kindle, or audio edition from Amazon.com today.